Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program, hour number two. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Our producers for this program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry is at the controls. We're also happy to have back here on the program Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She teaches at the U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign once every other month, always on Monday. She's here and we talk about women's health. She usually comes with a few things that are new that she knows that she can talk about. And we can also take questions. And that's really the reason for doing the program, is to give folks who are listening an opportunity to call in and ask questions. We do this to add to people's general health knowledge and to give them a place to start. And I hope whenever we have physicians here on the show, I always try to remind folks that, you know, because the doctor cannot see you, we can't do diagnosis over the telephone. Obviously, if you have a problem, you need to pursue it with your own physician or somebody who can see you. But we do this as an information resource, and basic questions are certainly fine. And whatever questions you have, I'm sure that the doctor will do her best to see if she can help you out. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. And that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So again, 333-9455. That's the number for Champaign-Urbana. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you want to give us a call, you can certainly do that. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
Glad to have you here. What would you like to talk about here to get us started out?
Well, there have been a number of news stories that I thought that we could talk about. I'm prepared to talk a little bit about some of the issues that have been in the media about the Gardasil HPV vaccine. I wanted to talk a little bit about the HPV virus and some new trials that I've been involved with, and what might be the difference between Gardasil, which is a prophylactic vaccine, and what might be coming in the future, some sort of a therapeutic vaccine. And I thought we could also talk a little bit about ovarian cancer and breast cancer and screening issues. I've talked a little bit about the Halo Breast Pap Test, which is a pap test for the breast to help us identify the precancerous changes that occur in breast cells before women become cancerous. And we've talked a lot over the years about using ultrasound and the blood test CA125 for screening for ovarian cancers. And now there's a new blood test called OvaSure that has been brought to the market. And it's actually clinically available. I thought I'd talk a little bit about that. There are some new things in the media regarding endometriosis and some new treatments. And our sexual dysfunction study for menopausal patients has changed a little bit in our protocol. So I thought if I have time, I'll get to that too, because I know it's been a couple of months since I've been here, and sometimes I don't even quite remember all the issues that we talk about to get back to. I know we often talk about osteoporosis. There was actually some new media studies, new studies talked about in the media regarding longer-term treatment with osteoporosis medicines, and I know many people are doing that. So first I was going to talk about the HPV vaccine. There was a report that came out a couple of days ago about some adverse events from vaccinations. The first things they talked about were people that actually fainted from their vaccine, and while that is not unusual to have a young woman faint from a shot, it is potentially something that can actually happen. And now they've started to accumulate rare reports of various vaccine-related events like neurologic disorders such as Guillain-Barré, which is a paralysis thing, thromboembolic events, in other words, throwing a blood clot, lymph system disorders, gastrointestinal problem, immune problems. And so Dr. Diane Harper, who was one of the investigators in some of the trials that I was involved in with Gardasil, has now said that we think that the cause of the recent complications remains a mystery. It's difficult to know whether they are involved in vaccines, but it is possible that they're somewhat related to the aluminum salt, but we think that those aluminum salts in these vaccines are very, very safe. But she is actually advocating a little bit of concern, and a fairly controversial gynecologist, Dr. Christiane Northrup, who sometimes appears on Oprah, I guess, appeared and said she was not going to vaccinate her children and that sort of thing because she was concerned regarding the vaccine. And she said it that her concerns dated back to the days when even when we were first identifying the so-called germ theory of disease, Pasteur's original work, and she said that she questioned some of this original work, which I know you're raising your eyebrow, me too, when I was reading this. But she backed Bucamp's theory, and his theory was that it's not so much the germ, but it's our response to the germ. And we do know that some people are able to mount an immune response that will clear the HPV virus, and it is definitely a goal to get more people to do that. And whenever I have patients that are suffering from HPV disease, I tell them that, in fact, 7 out of 10 women will probably clear their virus, and we think the better your immune system is, the better off you are clearing your virus. And I advocate vitamins and omega-3 vitamins and staying away from smoking and staying away from secondary smoke and getting better rest and getting better exercise and just living well as a way to enhance our immune system. And so there's been just a lot of argument. I guess the bottom line is that we feel these vaccines are very safe. I still feel that HPV disease is a very prevalent problem. We are embarking on a study right now where we're enrolling patients to be screened for the HPV virus with a new test. Several companies are trying to come out with a new test. There's only one HPV test out there on the market right now, the Digene Hybrid Capture 2, a very good test. FDA has approved this as primary cancer screening for women over 30. So you would go in, and in addition to your Pap test, you would get this HPV test to see if, in fact, you carry the HPV virus. And you would get this at least every 3 years if you test negative. More often if you would test positive or be in certain high-risk situations. But our new study is looking for women just due for their Pap smear. And specifically, we are looking at a new type of HPV test to see if that testing is going to be helpful in the management of these women.
All right. We have a couple of callers here and would welcome others. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana and toll-free 800-222-9455. These are callers both in Champaign, and we'll start here with line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Go ahead.
I was wondering if the doctor could speak briefly about a young woman I know who has had her first child by C-section. The child's about a year old now, and apparently now the young woman has a prolapsed uterus. And I just wonder if the doctor could talk about that a little bit, the dangers and the incidence in it of it in someone so young and the possible treatments.
Well, we usually classify prolapse in three categories: mild, moderate, severe. Mild prolapse immediately after carrying a child, whether or not that child is birthed vaginally or via cesarean, is quite common. And more severe forms of prolapse that occur are less common. The uterus is supported by the pelvic floor, which is a giant sling, and the main supporting ligaments in carrying the baby get a little bit stretched out. And those ligaments are usually composed of certain types of collagen. There are about 10 different types of collagen. And genetically, some of us have a little bit more collagen and a little bit less muscle. And some of us are a little bit flipped in terms of the amount of collagen and muscle. So you can think of your cheek as muscle and your nose as collagen. And certain of these ligaments of the pelvis are combination. And then so it's not just the percentage of collagen, but the types of collagen. We've always thought that once somebody gets prolapse, that it's somewhat progressive, but that's not really true. In a recent study published, we found that some patients actually improve when you study them over periods of time, like 3 to 5 years. In young people who are going to have more children, usually we treat them what's called symptomatically. So if they're having symptoms of their prolapse, we treat that. If they're not bad enough to actually have symptoms, we don't treat that. And when treating someone who's going to have children, usually it's not a surgical therapy, but either pelvic floor muscle exercises or being fitted for a device that holds things back in place. And there are many of these devices, but about 70% of women fitted with pessaries will be fitted with a ring type of device to hold things back into place. A lot depends on her pelvis, the anatomy. There are rings, there are cubes, there are inflatables, there are these Gellhorn things, there are these Hodges that look like kind of a weird folded kind of elongated shape. And a lot depends on the anatomy.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Let's talk again with somebody else here. This is also somebody in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Hi. I have been on antidepressants for 20 years and nearly 20 years, and as a result have the bad side effect of sexual dysfunction. I switched over to Wellbutrin within the last year, and it has not seemed to improve anything. And I'm wondering what's out there for women. Is there anything I can do?
Well, there are no approved medicines for treatment of sexual dysfunction in women. What's, of course, the most important is to get an accurate diagnosis. So the vast majority of women that I treat that are in either the perimenopause or the menopausal time have hypoactive sexual desire disorder. Some have female sexual arousal disorder. Some are somewhat responsive to hormones and some are not, but there's no actual approved medication. There is an over-the-counter medicine called Alvomil, and I'm one of the world's worst spellers, and it's spelled oddly, but it's something like A-L-V-I-M-I-L, something close to that. Is a combination of the various herbs that have over time been reported to help sexual function. And in a small, not well-controlled study, it showed slight benefit over placebo. You have to take it for 90 days. Whenever starting herbal medicine, so many herbs have increased propensity to bleeding that I always tell you to check with your own physician before starting anything, even over-the-counter, ideally, but that's a potential. There are no actual licensed sexual counselors in Champaign-Urbana either. My PA and myself have been certified in some areas of sexual counseling, but that's one area that we don't really have well covered in our community. Some therapists do work with various couples on various sexuality issues, so that's a potential. There's other things that some patients on long-term antidepressants can do. And again, you have to work very closely with your own therapist, but you can take a day off. So some patients, for instance, can move their medicine up to morning, take it Friday morning, skip the Saturday dose, skip the Sunday morning dose, start again taking that on Sunday. So you're actually really only skipping your Saturday dose, but you're stretching the doses out. Depending on what medicine you're on and depending on the half-life, sometimes the half-life drops down enough that there's a little bit of increased drive. There are several compounds under development right now that seem to work for hypoactive sexual desire and female sexual arousal disorder. Moving into Europe, they've already started getting some of these compounds approved. I've been involved in some of the trials. They do look promising, but nothing's on the market yet.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Let's go to Charleston for our next caller, line number four. Hello.
Yes, I called earlier, but I thought maybe you would know more about squamous intraepithelial lesions and HPV and low-grade cell changes, and maybe you could talk more about that, what that means to say that one has low-grade cell changes due to exposure to HPV. And also you talked about increasing one's immune response in order to clear the body, and you mentioned vitamins and omega-3 vitamins, but I was wondering where one would find out more about which vitamins and how much to take.
Well, there aren't a lot of very good studies on tackling the and study the end question first. There aren't a lot of good studies, but the ones that are the best have been studying specifically folic acid and just folic acid.
It's folic acid. I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
Yeah, it's a B vitamin, and also the just omega-3 is what's in fish oil, and most of us get it through supplements because the amount of fish that we have to consume is either just not in our diet styles, or if you really get up into high fish consumption, people start to worry about mercury, although I've talked to some of the nutrition professors here, and they say that's overstated. But at any rate, in terms of low-grade changes in the pap smear, mm-hmm. I'm not really clear on what your question is. Do you not understand what that is?
Yeah, I was just more curious as to what that means. What does it mean when it's low grade? I mean, it's not cancerous. I don't know if it means it's precancerous. It means it's been some kind of changes or effects due to exposure to HPV, apparently, or perhaps, you know.
Okay. So when we talk about cervical cancer, we feel that cells undergo a precancerous progression to become cervical cancer. And in order to actually have a firm diagnosis, you actually need a piece of tissue, a biopsy, to
yes.
prove that. Pap smears are a screening test looking for these sorts of changes.
Mm-hmm.
So we think that the cells first incorporate or get infected by HPV, then HPV gets incorporated such that it can induce a physical change in both the way the cell may behave and the look of the cell, and then the cells and the tissue get more abnormal. So that when we say someone has cervical cancer, they have these highly changed cells that grow deeper than the basement membrane, the top layer of the cervix, or exophytically out over the top. And so that is what an invasive cancer is.
Mm-hmm.
When those cells are contained within the top layer of the cervix, mm-hmm. we say that it is a precancerous conformational change. And we divide the cervix upper layer into thirds. And if on the tissue sample the abnormality is in the first third, we say it's mild dysplasia. If it's in the second third, we say it's moderate dysplasia. And in the third third, it's severe dysplasia, which is considered equivalent to carcinoma in situ.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The second and third are considered high-grade changes. In the first, and when the cells are only in the lower third, we say that that is low grade.
Okay.
We think that the fate of any abnormal pap to go on to become cervical cancer is quite low. There's hundreds of thousands of abnormal paps, and we have about 7,000 cases of cervical cancer in the United States each year, with about 3,000 women dying of cervical cancer in the United States each year. So it is a problem, but certainly not all those with abnormal paps go on to become invasive disease.
Right.
And we think that it's the high grade, these more moderate and severe or the worst looking cells on pap smears, that are most significant. And we think that those are typically due to what we call high risk HPV viruses, viruses that have the most potential to get incorporated into the cell, immortalize those cells so that they don't behave regularly, but they behave with a more aggressive growth.
Mm-hmm.
Low-grade changes typically are due to what we've nicknamed the low-grade HPV or the low-risk HPV viruses.
Okay.
The Gardasil vaccine I was talking about before has 6/11. Those are two of the most prevalent low-risk viruses of the HPV, and 16 and 18. Those are the two most prevalent high-risk viruses. In fact, we think that 16 and 18 together are responsible for about 80% of all cases of cervical cancer in the United States each year. We think that when women have these low-grade intraepithelial changes, it's of a concern. We can't ignore it, but it's most likely going to resolve. It's most likely not going to progress to an invasive cancer, and they can be managed much less aggressively.
Okay. Is that what you had to say then?
Yes.
Okay, I didn't want to.
Either that or we can sit here for another couple of weeks and we can keep going.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you for the call. Other questions are welcome. We are about midway through here in our conversation with Dr. Suzanne Troopen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She teaches at the U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign every other month. It's almost on a Monday she's here and we talk about women's health. And your questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just for a second to go back to the HPV vaccine. You were talking right at the beginning about how some people have some concerns about potential side effects, but that still the recommendation as far as you're concerned and the recommendation I think of most doctors is that it is a good thing and we're recommending that girls get it before they become sexually active.
The current recommendations are that the vaccine is approved from age 9 to 26. Ideally, girls of ages 11 and 12 will be vaccinated prior to becoming sexually active. We are currently recommending catch-up vaccinations. So in other words, sexually active people all the way up to age 26 to be vaccinated to prophylactically prevent infection with one of these four viruses. If a woman is already sexually active, likely she's been exposed to one of the four viruses already. But that's what large studies like the study that I'm embarking in is going to help tell us how many people are already infected.
Yeah. And I guess the question that I was thinking about was that now for people who are who have been sexually active, have had more than one sexual partner in their life and who are, say, 30, 40, 50, is there some thinking about a recommendation for having people who are over 25 years old, say, or over 29.
There is a second study that I was part of that has been done in women ages 25 to 45 and looking specifically at them, the safety of using the vaccine, the efficacy at preventing new infections, the efficacy at preventing cervical dysplasia. Much of that data has already been presented in the public, and it looked very, very favorably. That data has gone to the FDA here. It has not yet been approved for use in the United States. I believe there are a couple of very small countries where it is approved. It's not yet used in Europe or countries like that. Although I believe Australia was the first country to vaccinate boys, and I believe in parts of the European Union they're starting to vaccinate boys, and that's really a whole nother issue. Mm-hmm. But yes, absolutely, we are looking at the benefits of older women and boys as well.
All right. Somebody here on cell phone, line one, we'll get right to them. Hello.
Hi. I do have a quick question. You were just talking about the vaccinations for younger boys. And I'm reading some research online. There was some stuff on the Internet out of Europe, out of England, a medical journal there, that had kind of alluded to the fact that a man could get oral cancer from HPV. From a woman, as well as, cancer elsewhere. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, if you have heard any of that or if there's any research regarding that.
Well, we've known for a long time that cancers other than cervical cancer are related to the HPV virus. So, of course, the obvious vaginal, urethral, vulvar, rectal, anal cancers have been reported for a long time. We also have reported years and years and years ago laryngeal papillomatosis as due to the HPV virus. But for instance, even in somebody with a very active case of warts who delivers vaginally, the baby is only at risk 1 in 10,000 of getting that oral transmission in the process of the birth. So it's something that we've known about for many years and have been tracking. And yes, many head and neck cancers have been related. Now, most of the oral cancers, of course, are related to tobacco. And getting rid of smoking, getting rid of intense secondary smoke is what is going to get rid of most of the oral cancers out there. And we believe that tobacco is probably a significant cofactor in the development of any oral cancers as well. But oral cancers and various head and neck and even some cases of rare lung cancers have been linked to the HPV virus.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. One other question about this. The idea here of this vaccine would be to give it to people before they would ever be exposed to the virus. That would be the hope. But if we know that now that there are significant numbers of people who have indeed been exposed to the virus, you said that maybe there was some thinking about a different kind of therapy for that.
This HPV virus vaccine is what's called a prophylactic vaccine. So, in other words, if you get a good enough immune response, antibody response, it will prevent you from ever acquiring HPV viruses that you have not yet acquired, as long as they're covered for in this particular vaccine. Also, people are working on what has been nicknamed therapeutic vaccines. In other words, some sort of treatment, and you can use the word vaccine, or perhaps we need to come up with an entirely different terminology, but some sort of treatment that would enhance our immune system so that we would actually clear any infections that we have. Because as we know, we have treatments for the dysplasias, but we don't have good treatments for clearing the virus. It's something that we either have to hope for or we just wait and watch and see if it develops. So, yes, working on therapeutic vaccines, and there are about 3 or 4 companies actively pursuing that right now. Other treatments, medication kinds of treatments to help clear the vaccine are under development as well. Excuse me, to clear the virus. All those V words. Something about Mondays, huh? But yes, it's very exciting. And we have to understand that there are whole groups of the HPV virus that we think produce these effects. Now, we point to 16 and 18 as being the most significant high-risk viruses that we have out there, but there's a whole group. We usually test for 13 of them, and in some of the newer studies, we feel we should test for more like 15, 16 at least of these different viruses to determine what is the most high-risk viruses out there that we have to cover. And we know that even though this is only a quadrivalent vaccine, it has some cross-protection against types that aren't in the vaccine, but eventually development of vaccines that are against some of these rare subtypes are going to be important as well.
Well, is there now some sort of recommendation that women be tested to see if they've been exposed to the virus?
Well, that's a good question. It's not quite that firm, but the FDA has approved HPV testing over the age of 30 as a screen for cervical dysplasia. Fairly expensive test, not covered as well as pap smears.
Other questions certainly are welcome. People who are listening, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Our guest in our Focus 580 is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She teaches at the U of I Med School, and for a long time now she's been here on a regular basis to talk about women's health. She's here every other month on a Monday, and we're happy to take your questions, and I know she'll do her best to help you out. We have a caller here again, ready to go. Someone in Urbana. Let's talk with them on line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Dr. Troopen mentioned new treatments for endometriosis, and I'd like to hear something about that.
Well, there have been a lot of exciting new treatments for endometriosis. We've used the medication Danazol for a long time, an actual androgen medicine with some androgenic effects, and it works very effectively for the pain of endometriosis. But because it is an androgen, it has some known side effects of oily skin, weight gain, rare cases, deepening of the voice, rare cases, increased hair growth. As women age through menopause, you might notice some women, their estrogen levels go down, but their progesterone levels to androgen levels change significantly. And with androgen going up and progesterone going down, some women get that kind of downy hair on their face. That isn't very popular. So some androgenic side effects. So two different companies have been working on formulating this vaginally. And we see a lot of promise in being able to use that locally. So again, research product. We also have seen some research with, I like to nickname them sperm. So I talk a lot in the osteoporosis talks about SERMs, selective estrogen receptor modulators. Well, these are selective progesterone receptor modulators, so they bind directly to the progesterone receptor, and we think with that mechanism they can reverse some of the changes of endometriosis. So that has been a very promising avenue of research as well. In terms of things that are actually out there on the market, aromatase inhibitor. It's another use for a medicine already out there. We have...
I'm sorry, I didn't understand what came before inhibitors.
It's aromatase, and there are a class of medicines that we use for breast cancer treatment, and they're called aromatase inhibitors. Some people nickname them AIs, and they work on a different portion of the pathway to decrease the amount of estrogen in a woman's system. Again, approved for the treatment of breast cancer, or for, in some cases, now being used for the prevention of breast cancer. But that's not their approved. Their approval is for the treatment of breast cancer. We've been using them in our ovulation induction in infertility patients, so helping women get pregnant by the use of these medicines, particularly in women who haven't conceived on other treatments. And that's been extremely exciting and fruitful. And now there's been a new study published using these aromatase inhibitors in the treatment of endometriosis. Again, very new. Not very many gynecologists are probably going to feel comfortable using this, but it is something relatively new. Relatively new on the market also is the use of the Mirena IUD, the intrauterine contraception that has a levonorgestrel, a little bit of progesterone in it. And because that progesterone is leaked locally, that local leaking of progesterone actually helps decrease some of the pain and local symptoms of endometriosis. So that's been exciting new work. Relatively new has been the use of Depo-Provera 104. So many people are familiar with using the injectable progesterone contraception, Depo-Provera, for the treatment of endometriosis. And that dosage is 150 milligrams, and there is now a 104 milligram dose that is approved for treatment of endometriosis. I was involved in those research trials, and the published data showed very favorable profiles for endometriosis patients with that. And it's something that you can stay on a long time and hopefully avoid the treadmill of repeat surgeries that so many of our patients have to have.
That last one with the low dosage sounds like it might be a possibility. The person I know has pretty frequent pain, and she's not trying to get pregnant. She has kids, but she has ongoing endometriosis. And it sounds as if that's available now, right?
Oh,
the
yes.
Depo-Provera.
Yes, it is. And also in pain management with our chronic pelvic pain patients, I've started using protocols for bladder treatments and bladder instillation therapy that have helped chronic pelvic pain. And that's been successful working up the bowel to make sure there's no low-lying bowel endometriosis is important as well. So there are many strategies that we can actually use in our patients to hopefully get a successful treatment because it is a long-standing problem.
Thank you so much.
All right, thank you. About 10 minutes left. Again, the number to call, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She's an OBGYN, and she's here every other month. We talk about women's health. Questions are welcome. Now, in the first part of the program, we were talking about cancer, and we're doing that in a kind of a general way. The guest that we had on was a physician whose specialty was lung cancer, but we were talking generally. And in the beginning of the program, we talked about the fact that there has been a significant decrease in cancer deaths in the United States. And he said two things contributed to that. One is that we're getting people not to smoke. But the other thing is that we do have good screening for a variety of cancers, particularly, and I'm sure he's thinking about things like mammograms and pap smears and the tests that we can do to try to test for colon cancer and so forth. Specifically for cancers that affect women, what would you want to say about what we're recommending now for screening?
Well, I think that that is very true. And it's interesting you bring that up because their new Bethesda guidelines, a coalition of physicians who came through, has actually just decreased the number of pap smear screenings that they're recommending. So it'll be very interesting to see how those screenings actually will affect women. But mammographic screening has been extremely important in our treatment of breast disease. And now that we have the Halo breast pap smear, although I had the first machine in Illinois, and I think they got a machine at Provena, but I'm not really sure that they use it. But trying to screen for these early precancerous changes in the breast, I think will be critical. But definitely continuing to use screening is going to enhance the longevity because anything that you can pick up early is so extraordinarily treatable. Using these new blood markers for ovarian cancer screening, I think, is going to be exciting too.
Some other calls here. Next up is someone in Sydney. Line one. Hello.
Hello. Hi. Yes. Bear with me. I'm male. I'm getting the impression that perhaps cervical cancer is passed along by the male. Has there been any sort of intricate study of the difference between uncircumcised males versus circumcised males that may pass this along? And question two, if these men do have these viruses, how do these viruses affect them if they do at all?
Well, they have tried to look at whether circumcision is important in this particular cancer, and I don't think there have been any recent studies that were done well that shows that circumcision would decrease the rate of passing on cervical cancer. But it would be a very difficult study to do because the act of the intercourse and the cervical cancer are so widespread in number of years. In terms of the the effect of the virus on the men, it can produce penile cancer, but since the penile skin is so much tougher than the epithelial membranes of the vagina and the cervix that are exposed to the HPV virus, this is just a much rarer entity, just not something we see a lot in the United States, much more common in third world countries, and exactly why we're not sure. But in men, it can produce anal cancers, rectal cancers, urethral cancers, and we were already talking about some of the oral cancers that we think are linked as well.
Oh, Okay, thank you. That's what I needed to know.
All right, thank you.
Bye.
And it can produce genital warts. That's
correct.
That's sort of the thing that we always used to talk about before it became quite so obvious that there was this thing with with cancer. Yeah.
Good point.
Okay, very good. Matt Toon next, line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Dr. Troop, I mean, yes, Dr. Troop.
Yes.
I'd like to know if what is still used mostly for osteoporosis is Avesta as effective as Fosamax, or the other? There's another one you take less than Fosamax.
Okay, Fosamax is a bisphosphonate, and about 80% of people being treated for osteoporosis are being treated with a bisphosphonate, and we think the bisphosphonates are the most potent treatment for osteoporosis with better fracture prevention data than Avesta. Avesta is a SERM, a selective estrogen receptor modulator. It's an excellent medication. It has actually been approved for the protection of women against breast cancer, and it should approximately reduce your risk of getting an estrogen receptor positive breast cancer by about half when you take it. So it has other benefits than just on your bone. It also has other side effects as well, but it does have that additional benefit. But in terms of pure fracture prevention data on both the hip and other sites, but particularly the hips, the bisphosphonates are the best. Fosamax is the one product that has been around the longest, and so we have the most information about it, the most long-term published studies, and it comes as a once-a-week pill supplementation. The similar medication, Actonel, which has always been a once-a-week medicine, has now come out as a once-a-month treatment where you take it on Saturdays and Sundays. So it has come out with a once-a-month medication as well. The newest one, the one that Sally Fields advertises, most people know that Sally Fields advertises it, is Beneva. And it has been always a once-a-month formulation. Well, it exists in once-a-day pill form. All these actually do. And it actually comes as a 4 times a year intravenous supplementation. So one of the main side effects of these bisphosphonates is a bit of esophageal and stomach irritation. So reflux, GERD, just stomach irritation. When you take these medicines, they're poorly absorbed, so you have to take them on an empty stomach with a full glass of water and not eat or drink. In the case of once a week, for half an hour. In the case of once a month, for a full hour, and not lay back down because you don't want the medicine to kind of creep up into the esophagus. And for people who are still having their stomach upset problems, it's the Beneva has come as a 4 times a year intravenous supplementation. But now the newest kid on the block is reclassed, and it's a medicine, zoledronic acid, that's been used for many years in kidney and cancer patients who suffer bone loss, and now it is approved for the treatment and prevention of osteoporosis, and it's a once-a-year intravenous supplementation.
Intravenous.
Yeah, with the reclass, you said, and 15 minutes later, you're done for the year. So when you come in for your checkup, you can just poof, be done. You don't have to worry about fussing around with the glasses of water and all. So for many people, you're not sticking a needle anywhere close to them. But for some people, that option is really a terrific increase in convenience. Now, not every doctor's office is set up as a place for infusions, but it's been kind of exciting. But the bisphosphonates probably are a little more powerful than Avesta. And then all of those are anti-resorbative. They prevent that turning over of the bone. But to actually lay down new bone and get the biggest boost in your scores if you really have low scores or have very over-suppressed bone is parathyroid hormone. And that's a 2-year course of treatment injection. You come off your bisphosphonate, use that for 2 years, and then you get back on your bisphosphonate. But it's a little bit sophisticated and beyond this radio show to figure out exactly who would need that and when. So forth. It's a fairly expensive drug, and we have to work with our Medicare patients because they get that donut hole. So their medicines are paid for a while, and then they get into that stretch where they're going from one part of their payments to their others, and there's sort of a falls through the crack there, and then they got to get it picked up again. So we have to work with our patients to get them past that.
Well, I just took that DEXA scan, and I don't know how it came out yet, but.
Well, I think I talked about this on one of my last shows or two, but if you get on the National Osteoporosis Foundation website, great website, and you can go and talk about your Fraxic score, and it's the new way the World Health Organization is recommending that people look at whether or not they should be on medication. And if you don't even know your scores, you can play around with the numbers without even knowing your score. But they ask questions and give you a calculated statistical risk of your likelihood of a hip fracture or likelihood of any major osteoporotic fracture over the next 10 years.
I don't have 10 years.
and based on that, they talk about recommendations for medication. And I find it very, very useful because many of my patients – actually, we've changed a little bit, and we'll probably go with calcium, vitamin D, and exercise a little bit longer in some patients before we start medicine.
Well, I had this is the third scan I've had. So before, they said osteopenia.
Well, and we're trying, those of us that are certified densitometrists, in the International Society of Clinical Densitometrists, which I belong to, we are trying to get rid of that term osteopenia, but it's the equivalent of saying just lower bone mass. So there's no perfect number. It's a continuum. So even people with completely normal scores have some risk of fracture, and people with severe scores don't always fracture. So we're trying to get that concept. We're trying to get the concept of bone strength across, and it's not just how thick your bones are, but how healthy your bones are as well.
Oh, good. Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you for the call. If you could do everything to persuade women, starting when they were girls and as they grew up, to get plenty of calcium, plenty of vitamin D, have some weight-bearing exercise so that they would have – their bones would be as strong as you could possibly get them. What would that do for the incidence of osteoporosis?
Well, we think that it would definitely go down, and it's not that we can even go ahead. We're trying to prevent us slipping back because, for instance, pop is bubbly because of the phosphorus, and that phosphorus binds up calcium. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to munch your cheese pizza with a pop, you're binding up all that calcium in your pop, and that 20-year-old girl is just not getting what she needs. So she's going into her bone accrual years when she should be really packing on her calcium, and she's going into deficits that she normally shouldn't be having. So what we're looking forward to in the future is not necessarily lessening the burden, but a future where some of our dietary practices make us higher risk. They just came out with, we have a big obesity problem. Is being obese good for your bones, bad for your bones? We argue about this all the time. Well, in order to carry some weight, your bones maybe pack on a little extra calcium. So maybe that's a good thing. But if we're going to put you on a high protein diet to get your weight off, and they just came out saying that those high protein diets do lose faster than diets more loaded in carbs, well, maybe your kidney to eliminate that protein is going to have to pull some calcium with it. So what's going on there? Now, what about birth control pills? Well, if you use birth control pills, actually some very active women might be very low in estrogen. Using birth control pills might actually help her bones by giving her the estrogen she would have lost. So complicated formulas.
Okay, and we're trying to squeeze in one more person here. Champagne, line one.
Hi.
I
was wondering if you can take Avista and Vagifem at the same time.
Vagifem is a very low-dose estrogen local supplementation. We know that Avista, being a CIRM, has a certain risk of DVT, thromboembolic events, blood clots in the legs, so that if you take a medicine like Avista with an oral estrogen, they both increase your risk of blood clotting approximately to the same extent, so that would be doubling your blood clotting risk. But we feel that these vaginal estrogen treatments, whether they be pills, creams, in a ring, are low enough that we do not get systemic uptake, that we do not have any effect on the liver, and that it is not going to adversely affect our risk of blood clots, so that those medicines can be used simultaneously. That being said, there's also a medicine I was involved in research that I'm very excited about. Hopefully we'll have it at some point. And it's called Ofema. It's a cousin of Avista. Avista can be good for our bones. It can help prevent breast cancer, but it has no effect on the lining tissue of the vagina. Ofema is a CIRM that actually should have some beneficial effects, decreasing that vaginal dryness, improving that vaginal wall epithelium, and you might not need local estrogen.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, we're at the point here. We just about have to finish. 30 seconds or...
30 seconds. Somebody needs a pap smear, I can do it for them.
All right. Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troop, and she is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has a practice here in our area. She also teaches at the U of I College of Medicine, and every other month on a Monday in the 11 o'clock hour, she's here. We talk about women's health. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you. Here.